Senior Policy Fellow with the Perth US Asia Centre.
This is part two of my conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Wilson. Jeff has been the Perth US Asia Centre's inaugural research director, a role he has held for more than 4 years. Shortly, he'll take up a new role with the Australian Industry Group as its Director of Research and Economics.
Jeff, when I first met you, one of the very first things that you published for the Perth US Asia Centre was a report on geoeconomics. It was called Adapting Australia to an Era of Geoeconomic Competition. It was released in early 2021, and one of the main focuses was some of China's coercive trade practices against Australia. Relations between Australia and China have not improved over the last year. Things have only gone in a worse trajectory. I'm wondering, a year on, is Australia's next move in its relationship with China to actually diversify away from China and have things from different supply chains? What is really the lesson that Australia needs to take from what's happened in its trade relations with China?
Look, I think the lesson out of the Australia-China trade investment story, and we're seeing this play out for Europe and Russia right now as well. So it's not an Australia thing, it's not even a China thing, is really it's not the 1990s anymore. And there's a lot of people in professional positions have really only spent, in positions of authority at the moment, have only spent their professional careers kind of in that Cold War period where the general trajectory for the global economy was cooperation, rulemaking, and liberalisation. And it wasn't even, so some countries did it more than others, and we might have been disappointed by the pace. But it was getting easier to do international economic stuff and to build trade relations and to build investment relations. Every year it would be a bit easier than it was last year. And what we've had really since COVID, and China's had a trade war with Australia and several other countries before that, and now the Russia-Europe gas thing as well around Ukraine, which is the economic side of it, is that that's kind of snapped back, and it now does look a lot like the Cold War, where you've got these important trade relationships that cross barriers, but they're heavily politicised. Things moving back into a more political direction. And the trade economists who have already disowned me will be horrified for me to use this phrase, but we actually don't think about what you'd call kind of strategic or managed trade solutions, right? It's no longer for Australia or Germany or New Zealand or the United States enough to say, oh, we'll liberalise stuff at the WTO and then businesses just go out and trade with whatever. It's a free international market. It's not a free international market. It's highly politicised, and we're seeing these relationships used as strategic weapons against us. So we really need to think about, well, if there's a strategic risk on some of these things, how, as businesses, as governments, can we ensure there's a lot more resilience in that? That's about energy security. It's about supply chains. It's about critical tech. It's about the whole thing. But it's not the 1990s anymore, and you can't just do a trade agreement and let the market sort it out. Because that's how we end up in a trade war with China or the Gazprom weapon being held over the EU right now.
So, okay, taking that then, is Australia's current policy settings correct for that new future that we face, or would you actually wave a magic wand and change certain things in our approach now to set us up for a better future?
No, they're not, but we are trying. So I don't know if that's a criticism. It's look, we had a long period in Australia where we were a pretty good offensive negotiator in terms of opening markets for our stuff. And for 20 years as a trade or investment policy specialist, that was your job to go out and how can we sell more Australian stuff in booming markets in Asia or build the investment links that were needed to do that, right? That's been the game for almost an entire professional generation. And this, it's kind of become apparent in the last 2 to 3 years that's no longer going to be the game anymore. And we are scrapping around trying to go, it's almost like getting your grandfather's toolbox out and going right down into the bottom and finding some really old stuff. You're like, oh, remember when we used this in the 60s kind of thing?
Will this work again?
It is your grandfather. And I mean, I benefited from this. One of my PhD supervisors was Stuart Harris, who some from DFAT may know. He was the inaugural secretary that brought the Department of Trade and Department of Foreign Affairs, did the merger in the 80s. And his first job in government was negotiating the Australia-Japan Commerce Agreement, our first trade agreement, in 1956. So really, I benefited during my PhD a lot from talking to Stuart about like what it was like at the time to do some of that stuff when the first trade delegations to China in the 70s, when the Cultural Revolution was still going on and Mao was still alive. How did you manage that kind of thing, right? they're the frame, the historical analogies that give us a way to kind of work through this. So it is, a lot of it's going to be everything old as new again for this stuff. And I think we're moving in that direction, but it is hard because no one in, when it's not our lifetimes when we've used these kind of tools in the past. So we're really going to have to, you know, go and hit the library and the stacks in the ANU library.
So we can still learn from history of trade. It's not like things have moved along so much that previous lessons are no longer applicable to current trading situations.
No, there's times like this, and I draw an analogy, you know, to the Australia-China trade relationship when it started in the 70s. It was, China wasn't a market economy. It was, this is in the early 80s, they were still experimenting with private markets at this point. And so when you first start having that, there was serious questions asked as to how do we have an economic relationship with this country that it's all state-owned and they could manipulate these markets to their advantage and our disadvantage, which is the exact same debate the Americans are having over their trade with China at the moment. Like, China's state capitalist and it's an unlevel playing field. How do we level it back up? And Trump tried with a trade war that failed because it was a dumb tool he used. But what's a smarter tool that you can actually negotiate something in that space? That's the same stuff we had to deal with back in the 70s. And so it's not, nothing's new completely, but it's not what we've been doing for the last 30 years. So we're going to have to get a bit creative about not just going back to muscle memories. This is how I sell an Australian widget in Asia, because that's not the game any longer.
Hmm. The next thing I want to ask is actually about a book that you authored in 2017. The academic volume was called International Resource Policies in the Asia Pacific. Can you give a quick synopsis of that piece of work? And then 6 years later, can you say how your views have or haven't changed in that policy space? So, you know, critique yourself from the past.
Oh, what was wrong? Okay. That was my last book in academia. It might be the last one I ever write now, actually. But it was, if you've ever written one, they're horrible. Don't do it. Don't do it. So what I was kind of trying to do with that book was actually get the synthesis between the politics of international trade relationships and the economics of it. And the question of it was, why do you have these international resource trade, you know, where resource-rich countries sell to resource-poor countries? Sometimes that's a cooperative relationship and sometimes it's a really conflictual one or one that's filled with contestation. The example that you could use is Australia's like mineral exports to Japan and China. So we've had that relationship with Japan since the 1950s. It's been very beneficial. It's given the country something that they've got in common. And, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen a whole lot of security and diplomatic stuff built on top of that trade relationship. And then you look at Australia-China and it's the same commodities, iron ore, coal, gas, base metals. But it hasn't been anything like that. Long fights about Chinese investment in Australia, manipulation of international markets, dependence, and trade war and all that kind of stuff. And so what the book tries to do is basically say the economics alone can't explain those differences about how this industry works. From an economic point of view, Australia's resource trade with Japan and China look identical. So what is it that makes them different? And this comes from some of the politics that overlays this, particularly some of the geopolitics around global energy trade, which we see at work in Russia, Ukraine today, and particularly also sometimes around domestic politics of this and rent seeking and institutions and state capitalism that you have in a country like China. So what really tried to do is, and I think you see this playing out in the whole gas question for Europe around Russia right now, is what happens when a mutually beneficial trade relationship that worked at one point for both sides suddenly goes wrong for political reasons. How do you find a way through that? I'd say it's probably held up okay, but I'm the author, so of course I wouldn't say that.
So does that book that you wrote in 2017, does it still have salient lessons for today when you look at the Russia-Ukraine issue? Because I'm sure, I mean, it's a question I've wondered, is in terms of the trade sanctions that have been put on Russia, they've been put on Russia very fast and very hard, and some people argue that a more gradual increase can lead to, you know, more of a change in the Russian regime's approach. Do you think that the way sanctions were enforced was correct, or would you have done it differently?
Yeah, so there's a whole literature about sanctions. It's one of the oldest arguments in international relations is, do sanctions work, which is a dumb question because, like, define work, right? Like, what are you trying to do with them? And typically the history has been pretty small stuff, like a small problematic country in North Korea or Cuba or Venezuela, sanctions on them to try and do regime change in a, you know, resource exporting tin pot country kind of thing. And they probably haven't really ever created the regime change or the democratisation we've wanted. So some people would say, oh, they don't work. I mean, what we're doing with Russia here is a completely different thing. We're basically trying to destroy their economy, but not the economy of a small Caribbean island. We're trying to destroy the economy of the, you know, it's Russia's slightly larger than Australia. It's the world's 10th largest economy, right? And the question there is to deliberately starve off Russia's ability to do war fighting in Ukraine. That's going to take months to work through. And I think it was, people got very angry, and you can understand the emotions, right? The footage we've seen from Ukraine's horrifying. Why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we doing more? Throw the kitchen sink at these guys. But it is important that it's coordinated, and that takes time, you know, that you get a whole bunch of Western countries, it's the EU and the G7 plus us coming along and saying, you know, the US can't sanction Russia's central bank on its own. It only works if we all agree to lock off their reserves that are held in foreign exchange. So the fact that it took some time to do that, I'm really heartened that it only took about a week. That's immensely good international coordination. I'm sure anyone who's ever done any multilateral negotiations will be going, how much that have been gone overnight. But we're going to have to wait for it. It's not going to change the situation on the ground today. You have to starve the Russian economy out, and that's a question. Most people would probably say May, June, July, that they're looking at economic collapse. So it unfortunately doesn't solve the humanitarian horror in Ukraine going on at the moment.
Sort of related to this question about Russia and Ukraine is, as we see a conventional war being fought with tanks and bombs, we're also seeing this trade war being fought. But a lot of the time within governments, there's a lot more attention and concern about the guns and bombs stuff rather than what the impact of a trade war can have. In your view, what needs to change either with the Australian government or just governments internationally about how they respond to and think about trade wars?
I think this one's almost sociological, and it really gets to how you go through the job in foreign policy and how you get trained and socialised and what networks you're part of. I mean, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but there are kind of these different cultures and silos. So there's trade nerds, they're down in the basement in KC, and they know every tariff rate quota and rule of origin rule and stuff like this. Don't know anything about guns and bombs. I do tariff rate quotas kind of thing. And then in Russell, various other security agencies, you've got people that do strategic analysis and military balances, counting up who's got missiles and tanks in different locations and what the strategic implications of that are. But never the twain shall meet. And it's very rare to see someone, I challenge anyone, do you know anyone that's like this in Canberra, right? Who's actually worked back and forth across those two tribes. Generally, you end up in one silo and you go up inside it. And so you get to these situations that we've had here where there's a military war going on between Russia and Ukraine. But then there's also what is now clearly an economic war being fought by the G7 plus against Russia in support of Ukraine militarily. And who's able to get their head around how those two things interlock? If you've got a professional system, and this isn't just true of government, it's in academia. When I did my PhD, you did IPE if you did trade, and you did security studies if you did guns and bombs, and you went to different seminars, and you read different stuff, and you had different supervisors. You occasionally went to the other one's seminar if there was good food on, but that was it, right? in the Headley Ball Building.
Or just to see what the other side was doing.
Yeah, and you'd come out of it with a really delicious croissant in your mouth, going like, what the... You know, those guys talking about, right? Like, but that was about it, right? So it's not just a government problem. It is this kind of breaking that down. I mean, and that's what I said about think tanks. The great thing about it is you're allowed to be transgressive in a way that a lot of the other, you know, promotion structures don't allow that. I think that, you know, what we've got to take out of this is we've got to find a way to change that. Why is it that in someone's late 20s are they expected to become a trade specialist or a military balance specialist or a diplomatic specialist, and then that's all you do until you retire? That's not going to be fit for purpose for the 21st century Australia's got. So how do we break that down?
One of the other issues you've written about, Jeff, is the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known as the CPTPP. Originally, it was the TPP when the United States was involved prior to the Trump presidency. Then after the United States left, Australia and Japan really kept the agreement going. I wanted to find out from you, in a perfect world where you could have the members that you wanted in this group, and it could actually help with setting the rules of the road for trade, what would you like to see the CPTPP evolve into?
Mm, that's Really good question. And there's a lot of debate about this. Like, if you read anything on the CPTPP, the questions people ask is, will America ever rejoin? Probably not. Is China serious about its application to join? Also probably not, right? But the contextual factor for this is, unfortunately, the World Trade Organization is basically stuffed. It hasn't negotiated anything for 20 years. The enforcement mechanism, which is a dispute settlement thing, hasn't been working for 2 years now, so there's no court functioning either. And so countries that are committed to some kind of rules-based quote-unquote trade system are having to come up with something else. So what else do we do if things are bogged down in political conflict in Geneva? And the Indo-Pacific's kind of got two answers to this that are actually complementary. Like, one's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, agreement, which is the ASEAN plus five members that's just kicked in force on the 1st of January this year. And a lot of people might say, look, it's not as high quality as the CPTPP, but it's a really good lowest common denominator. It provides the region a single integrated trade bloc, like the EU's got for Europe. So we've all got a single integrated trade agreement. Our stuff can move seamlessly across borders. And the ambition's not as high, but that's because it's got Cambodia and Malaysia and Japan and Korea and Singapore in it. Like, if you're going to have a lot of people inside the tent, you're going to have to be a little bit less ambitious about how big the tent's going to, how high the tent's going to be. In that context, the role of the CPTPP is effectively, you know, what we'd call a like-minded coalition or a mini-lateral thing. So who in the region is ready to do more from the lowest common denominator that we got to with RCEP? Whether that's on services, which is increasingly, you know, modern economies aren't going to be based on big factories pumping out stuff made of steel. They're going to be based on services and technology and intellectual property. In all of those areas, how could a smaller group take that ahead? So you've effectively got a standard that everyone can agree to, and those who are ready to go a bit harder then do this through the CPTPP. So the real question there is, how can we take that forwards? A lot of people will focus on membership, but the real question is actually not that it gets everyone in the region, because it's not supposed to be. Mm. You've got a large group of acquaintances that you hang out with, but you've got a small group of friends that you're tighter and closer with, and the analogy is the same for these. So the real question coming up now, just because it's been the Korean presidential election, is can Korea go through? Because it's the missing link for a big developed economy that's got all of that stuff. It's the previous government said they wanted in. Can we get that done over the next 12 months? And then what does it look like that we can do after that?
That question rounded out my discussion with Dr. Jeffrey Wilson. Jeff now commences a new role with the Australian Industry Group as its Director of Research and Economics. I hope you'll join me next time for another round of 15 Minutes in Canberra. Bye for now.